20-5091 United States versus Bertram. And counsel, Ms. Waltz, we are ready whenever you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Barbara Waltz and I represent Mr. Bertram in this appeal. When the government charged Mr. Bertram with a sexual act of a child, the government took on the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that there had been intentional touching, not through the clothes of the child's genitalia. The government did not establish that at the non-jury trial, and therefore Mr. Bertram asked that this court reverse and remand for an entry of not guilty on count one. Here at the outset of the argument, it's important for us to note the difference between count one and count two, which is also the difference between these two statutes that we're talking about today. The first category that Congress put into these statutes was sexual act. And 2246 sub 2 has four categories of sexual acts, which obviously Congress considered to be the more serious set of crimes compared to the second set, which is the sexual contact. In the sexual act, the first three, A, B, and C, involve penetrative acts, and then the fourth, D, involves intentional touching of the genitalia, not through the clothing. And that's the exact language of this statutory definition, not through the clothing. The second category is sexual contact, and it differs from sexual act because it can be through the clothing or not through the clothing. And it has additional body parts, not just genitalia, but things, other body parts like the buttocks, for example. If an adult touches a child's buttocks intentionally and with the intent that's specified, you know, basically a lascivious intent, that's never a sexual act. That's always sexual contact because of these definitions that Congress put in these laws.
In looking at the sufficiency of the evidence question, the question for us is whether no rational trier of fact could have found the essential elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, here the testimony is the child was asked, did he touch you under or over the clothes? And he said, both. I mean, from that testimony, couldn't a rational trier of fact find that it was skin-to-skin contact?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that that inference can be, that that's a reasonable inference that can be made. And may I go on with what the ambiguity is? First, the first ambiguity is which part of the body he's even talking about. Because
well, you didn't make that argument to the district court. So I've got a problem on raising it now. I don't remember an argument to the district court that he was referring to his butt and not his penis.
In the Rule 29, I honestly, it's been a long time since I've reread that part of that transcript, Your Honor. But if we're not talking about body parts, because I think that is a basic ambiguity in the child's testimony, that the first thing he said was buttocks. Well, he said around my butt or near my butt.
By my butt.
So the very first body part that he mentions is not part of a sexual act. And again, the government had to prove that. And so from then on.
Well, then he gets a graph of a body and
yes.
says, put an X on what we're talking about. And he X's the penis.
He circles the penis, according to what the U.S. attorney
said.
I'm
sorry, X's the butt, circles the penis.
Right. And the U.S. attorney announces, let the record reflect. He circled the penis and he put a cross on the buttocks, on the butt, sorry. And from then on, his answers and the U.S. attorney's questions all talk about bad parts. So we don't know if the child was referring to butt or penis. The U.S. attorney never said, let's only talk about just the penis here. Can you and I agree that when we say bad parts, we mean penis. We don't mean
that. Hadn't he already done that with the circle and X and already said it's the penis part that I'm talking about?
Well, but the child didn't say anything. He just circled the penis. And
well, I know, but I mean, isn't that the evidence, the testimonial evidence of that he was talking about the penis?
But It was never said out loud, even by the U.S. attorney. All she said was, let the record reflect that he circled the penis.
You're not saying the record didn't really reflect what was represented to have been reflected. You never challenged that.
Your Honor, I think we challenged the sufficiency of the evidence. And this is just an unclear record. And it was the government's burden to prove this and to make this clear. And the government never cleared up this ambiguity that started at the very beginning of the child's testimony.
And the government clearly was using the terms that the child used by saying bad parts, but it first had the child define that by circling the penis. But there's more than that. There's also the testimony of the child where he literally demonstrates through hand movements how the defendant touched him. And, you know, if the standard here is whether any rational trier of fact could conclude from the totality of the record here, it seems to me that's pretty convincing that he's talking there about a penis and not a butt.
Yes, Your Honor, but then we get into the other ambiguity that you mentioned first, that under the clothing and over the clothing ambiguity, because the statutory definition, again, is not through the clothing, which I believe the government has agreed means it needs to be skin to skin direct contact, that there can't be a layer of clothing in between. And the U.S. attorney never made that clear that there was direct contact. And even the hand gesture, Judge,
The hand gestures, I think, is a real problem for you, because you wouldn't have that hand gesture demonstrated if it was over the clothing. But putting that aside for a minute, what was the actual statement made, or at least postulated to the child? Was it under the clothing or under the pants or under the what?
I believe that the U.S. attorney said, did he touch you over the clothing? And I think the boys said yes. And then she said, and did he touch you under the clothing? I think she may have asked it as a compound question, but he said both.
Yeah. So clothing is a broad term of clothes you put on. And that would, I would think the normal interpretation of that would mean any clothing. And that would include underpants as well as trousers.
Right. But the U.S. attorney never specified that. And we're talking about a young child who's testifying here. And even the hand gesture, I would argue, could have been under the pants, but over the underwear. And if it was over the underwear, that's not direct skin-to-skin contact. So we're having to make a lot of inferences here in order to get to where the government was. And this was the government's burden, and they could have cleared this up with a question about the underwear.
Unless you argue that underwear is not part of clothing, I don't see any ambiguity myself.
I'm sorry, Judge?
Well, I think your argument is dependent upon your saying that underwear is not clothing.
And I don't see that myself, Judge, because when he gave a specific example, you know, she asked, how did his hand get under your pants? That was the specific example. And he said, from the top. But she didn't say, and under your underwear. So it's not, we're not saying that underwear isn't clothing. We're saying that when the U.S. attorney asked specific questions, she didn't include underwear in that question. She included pants. She said, how did his hand get inside your pants?
Well, and literally, I'm confused. I thought I asked, and I thought you answered, that the question, that there was a question, did he touch you under your clothing? And he said, yes.
Yes, he said both, under and over. And I understand what you're saying, Judge. What I'm trying to say is clothing, you're right, that's the statutory term is clothing, that it could, it had to be not through the clothing. And clothing, he said both, under and over. But at the same time, I think the testimony was not clear that it was direct skin-to-skin contact, which I think is required. And I think this,
well, you say it's required, but I can you point us to any case where we've said it has to say skin to skin, has to be in the testimony? In fact, I'm going to point you to a case. It's unpublished from the 10th Circuit, United States versus Magnin, in which we said that under their clothes was sufficient.
Yes, Your Honor, Magnin was written by Judge Ide and was an unpublished decision. And it had to do what the panel was actually discussing at that moment when they used that language was a jury instruction that had not properly stated the law. And so what the panel was saying was that there was sufficient evidence to prove this, that it had the incorrect jury instruction had not substantially affected the defendant's rights. There's no indication.
Because under the clothes was sufficient.
Your Honor, my distinction about that is that there's no indication that the defendant raised the issue that we're raising here. There's no indication that the defendant said, well, under the clothing's not good enough because of this ambiguity. The ambiguity here was not was inserted into the evidence, and the government never cleared up that ambiguity. That's different from Magnin, where we don't have any idea that there was any ambiguity, and that we have no idea what the evidence was based on that unpublished decision. And this was like the last paragraph of the decision that just mentioned this.
So when you say that ambiguity was inserted here, and I'm just trying to find out where you find the ambiguity. It's the question where it said, did he touch you under or over your clothing? And the child answered both. You think that's ambiguous as the skin to skin touching?
Yes. And one way that I think the ambiguity was in there was when she went through the clothing that he had on. She went through a lot of articles of clothing. She never mentioned underwear. She never mentioned socks. And again, when she was asking the specifics of how the hand got inside the pants, she only said pants, and she didn't say and underwear, and she never mentioned underwear. And again, it's the government's burden, to prove these things beyond a reasonable doubt. And so they're the ones who have to make sure this is clear, and they didn't do that. Like the Eighth Circuit said in the White Bull case, the government simply did not put on simply failed to present sufficient evidence when the little girl said it happened five times. And the first time she had sufficiently explained what it was because her underwear and her pants were down. So she was unclothed and the defendant touched her. So in that case,
there was absolutely no testimony about the other four events other than it, whatever it meant. I think this case is closer to the first crime in that case, because in both instances, there was never any testimony. Yes, it was skin to skin. It was just testimony that my clothes were off.
Right. But in our present case, in Mr. Bertram's case, there was no testimony that the child was ever unclothed. The child was clothed the whole time. His testimony was that Mr. Bertram's hand went inside his pants with no specificity that it also went inside underwear. And again, remember, we could be talking about buttocks at this point too, because the child simply said bad parts. He didn't say penis. He didn't say the front part of my pants. He was just saying in the pants. And so if that was the buttocks, then again, that's not a sexual act. That's sexual contact, which Mr. Bertram did not appeal from the conviction on count two, which is sexual contact, because there was sufficient evidence of that. So I think the other cases that we cited also, besides the White Bull, we have the, I guess when we're talking about 10th Circuit cases, and I agree, Judge, that this is not the sexual act thing, but the Farmer case that we cited, that's perjury, that the defendant may not be assumed into the penitentiary, this panel would be assuming Mr. Bertram into his life, mandatory life sentence on the sexual act, count one, if it affirms this. I see that I only have 30 seconds left, and I'd like to reserve those, please.
Thank you. Ms. Alam?
Thank you, Your Honor. Lena Alam for the United States. I'd like to first start by addressing Whitehall. I think that the key there, as here, is that in a sufficiency case, the question isn't whether a reasonable fact finder could possibly conceive of an alternative explanation for the evidence, but whether any reasonable finder of fact could have concluded that the defendant touched the victim, the genitalia of the victim, under his clothing or not through the clothing. And in addressing what the evidence established here, I think it's important to look to the specific questions that were asked by the prosecutor. Contrary to what Ms. Woltz suggested, when the prosecutor asked the first question, she asked, did he touch you under or over your clothing? That was one question, and he said both. But the second question was not, how did he get his hands in your pants? It was, how can you tell me how he got his hands under your clothes? And the victim said he would put his hand inside my pants. And to the extent that leaves those two statements in conjunction leave any ambiguity, the victim's testimony about showing the court how Mr. Bertram used his hand eliminates that ambiguity. And even if there were an ambiguity, because this court must consider the sufficiency of the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, taking all reasonable inferences also in the light most favorable to the verdict, there is no basis for reversal on this count. And although the Forster case, which cites the Third Circuit's Hayward case, does establish that skin-to-skin contact is required for a conviction of a sexual act for aggravated sexual abuse under 2241C, that requirement of skin-to-skin contact isn't a requirement that the victim testify using the words skin-to-skin. Here, the victim testified that the defendant was touching his bad spots. The prosecutor asked the victim to clarify where those bad spots were by circling them. Unlike in the other case law, in this case, the picture that the victim was circling was anatomically specific. It wasn't gender neutral. And the victim specifically circled his penis in response to the question, what do you mean by bad spots? The reference to his buttocks was not creating ambiguity. And I think our brief may have muddled this issue a little bit, but if you read the actual testimony, when he said, like by my butt, the victim was not answering that his butt was a bad spot. He was using a vaguer term, and therefore the prosecutor came back and gave him a picture to identify specifically what he meant by bad spots and distinguished his butt by asking the victim to X out, but so he could identify what the bad spots were and what the butt was and see the distinction between those two things.
Is the argument about the bad spots being ambiguous new on appeal?
To the extent the word, I don't think the word ambiguity or ambiguous was used in the Rule 29 motion. However, because the standard of review for a sufficiency claim effectively ends up being de novo in any event, but taking the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, I'm not sure that it matters that it was not raised below, but we would prevail under that standard of review in any event.
What about the restitution award? Was it supported enough by, was it certain enough?
This case held in Julian and citing the Ninth Circuit's Laney case, it's not that the court must come up with a certain amount for restitution, but that it estimate the restitution amount with reasonable certainty. And specifically here, unlike many restitution cases, the restitution award was under Section 2248, which, like the Section 2259 that was addressed in Julian and Laney, was enacted at the same time as the restitution statute in 2264. Those three statutes all, as Julian recognizes, are much broader than the restitution, than the general restitution statute in 3663A, because they involve violence against women and children. And they specifically provide for the types of treatment here. And all the courts interpreting those restitution statutes have acknowledged that the defendant's argument, which was, at least in the district court, that the victim should have to come back if additional therapy was needed and make a presentation to the district court, sort of flies in the face of congressional intent in adopting these very specific restitution statutes that require, that mandate restitution for the full amount of the victim's losses, including any costs incurred by the victim for physical, psychiatric, or psychological care. So rather than wait and put the burden on the victim to come back, these specialized restitution statutes anticipate that the district court should be able to make a reasonable estimate of the amount of future psychiatric care needed. And that's what the court did here. In Julian, of course, there was no evidence in the record that supported the district court's restitution award. And here, in contrast, there was, because the therapist herself, who ran the Horses of Hope program for the equine therapy, established that at least a year of therapy would be needed, and that there could be tapering thereafter, but that the victim, given the kind of abuse he suffered, may still need weekly sessions at the two-year mark. Given those that combined testimony, the district court's decision, which took the 1 year of therapy that the defendant agreed was appropriate and the 2 years of therapy requested by the government, which the therapist's testimony could have supported, the district court's decision that 1 year of testimony at once a week and another year of another year of therapy at two times a week was an appropriate amount. And the record amply supports that restitution award, given, again, the specific purposes of this restitution statute.
Thank you.
If there are no other questions, I would cede the rest of my time.
Can I just jump in? Can you address the Eighth Amendment argument?
Sorry, I could not hear which case.
Oh, that's me.
Oh, did you say the Eighth Amendment argument?
Yes.
Yes. In short, this court and the Supreme Court have consistently held that a sentence of this type for a recidivist sex offender is not cruel and unusual. The gross disproportionality principle reserves constitutional violations for extraordinary cases. Here, the district court found that Mr. Bertram was a repeat sexual predator of minor children, and Congress specifically provided in 2241C that someone like Mr. Bertram, a repeat sexual predator of young children, would not just have the option of a life sentence, but shall be sentenced to life in prison. Given that the Supreme Court has affirmed a life sentence for possession of 672 grams of cocaine, a sentence here under the circumstances of the defendant's crime and his prior conviction, and in fact, the testimony that came out at trial that he had in fact attempted to molest another young relative in between those two convictions, this statute is neither facially nor as applied to Mr. Bertram unconstitutionally cruel or unusual.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the panel?
I'm good.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And Ms. Walls, I think you have 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Unless there's questions, I would just ask that you reverse for the reasons that we've given the count one, the sexual act, because the the evidence, even with reasonable inferences in favor of the government, was not sufficient to carry the government's burden here, and that no reasonable jury could have found Mr. Bertram guilty of the sexual act beyond a reasonable doubt. My time is up.
Thank you very much. We will take this matter under advisement.